calling it the devastating setback of his life. After a police bust during a trip to Florida to check on his marijuana crop, Lyman narrowly escaped jail time by promising to find a job. The job, of course, was playing with the Jim Queskin Jug Band. Here Lyman's life becomes unmistakably rooted in Massachusetts. You can tell from the references that begin to appear in his journals. I walked into Dunkin' Donuts, and the waitress talked to me about poetry. Dunkin' Donuts. There in Lyman's diary from 1963 is the first inkling of things to come. I am indeed a supreme being and deserve to be in the company of gods like myself. In another journal entry from 1966, he curiously writes, I'm soon lost in a sea of color and all that astral jazz. Broadside of Boston noted his arrival in September 1963, welcoming him as a devoted follower of Guthrie. By then, Lyman was living in Queskin's attic in Cambridge, working steadily with the band, picking up solo gigs all over Boston, and trying to shake that lovelorn feeling. He noted in a 1965 journal entry that loneliness was his sole motivation. It wouldn't be long before Mel Lyman took the darkened Newport stage alone, harmonica in hand. Later, in Sing Out magazine, Irwin Silber called Lyman's Dylan-chasing performance the most optimistic note of the evening. Which brings the story to where it began. A mournful Rock of Ages performed on harmonica. A tiny hole for all that spirit to go through. That little tiny reed. And now it can end. With mourning for Mel. Mel Lyman worked hard to become a public figure. He was known for his music and notorious for his leadership of the Fort Hill community. It's baffling that the 1985 announcement of his 1978 death sparked no apparent investigation into what happened. Faking your own death, in the eyes of either the public, government, or your family, is extraordinarily difficult, requiring a permanently private life with no contact with the outside world. There is no doubt that Lyman was in poor health for most of the 70s. The dozens of framed photographs of Lyman that hang in the family's houses depict a man growing progressively ill, David K. Johnston reported in 1985. His private writings speak intimately of approaching death. It seems likely that, on some level, his family was telling the truth that he died, even if the dates they provided seemed mysteriously off. I follow several false leads, including a Cambridge folk singer who tells me he attended Lyman's funeral just 15 years ago in the early aughts. The bombshell is diffused before the end of the call. As the conversation suggests, he's experiencing some form of dementia. Then one day, someone with a connection to the community, a reliable source, agrees to talk. Why the secrecy surrounding Mel's death? Because it's illegal, what happened. What happened? He committed suicide. In California, where the act took place, suicide is not illegal. But advising or assisting a suicide is. It's unclear if the family assisted in any way, but Lyman informed Fort Hill's inner circle that it was going to happen. After fighting a long illness, Mel had decided to stop battling his own body. It was a weird way to do it, but it was his way, the person says. The rampant rumors were entirely false. Lyman did not take on a new identity and head to Europe. According to the source, he purposefully overdosed on drugs in Los Angeles, California, sometime in 1978. What was done with his remains is unclear. His final writings, shown to David K. Johnston in 1985, can be taken at face value. I know I'm done, and I'll stop keeping that body alive. It really is a lot of dead weight, and I don't feel it's got much more use. Do you know what I'm saying? I was Emerson, I was Lincoln, I was Woody Guthrie, and many more, but only for short periods of time. And I used those instruments because they were ready for me, and I used Mel Lyman in the same way, and I am nobody. I just am. Don't be sad. I'll be Mel Lyman as long as I can, and in fact I may bring him back with a bang and light him up like a neon bulb, and if I don't, it's because it wasn't. And if I do, we will have a real Melvin Christ on our hands. Because only certain information about what happened was distributed to various tiers of the family's members and children, and due to the passing of a man who had spiritually united them, or controlled them, for over a decade, it was a deeply traumatic event for the Fort Hill community. Several members simply could not accept that he was gone. That's when Jesse took over, one tells me. I think back to Jesse Benton's childhood daydream, the one where she's secretly Persephone, the beautiful queen of the underworld. The last time Ray Reapin saw Benton in a Kansas City bar over a decade ago, their conversation was abruptly curtailed by several men behaving unusually territorially. Thugs, he describes them. Reapin then wonders aloud about how much of Benton's leadership style might have been gleaned from her late husband. The Fort Hill community thrived on conflict. There was nothing holier than those moments when members got real, confronting one another with difficult truths. Sometimes this resulted in fistfights on the stage of Club 47, or the destruction of a magic theater they had spent years building, or holding someone in solitary confinement inside the vault. Their unspoken law is that you must struggle with the other person, a psychologist friend of the community once said. Among ex-members, this is the reason most often cited for leaving. Their lifestyle forces them to constantly examine and reveal themselves, and it is not easy to live when you are constantly personally exposed, Wayne Hansen explained after his departure. It all sounds unimaginably intense and exhausting, yet they remain, for the most part, together. There are few examples of communal living societies founded in the 60s that still exist to this day, and certainly none that were so notorious during their heyday. In their own strange way, the Fort Hill community are survivors. As Jim Queskin tells me, we were and still are a beautiful family. From the outside, though, it seems that what they have survived is themselves. In 1975, for reasons unknown, the Fort Hill community reset their calendar year to 00. Up on Fort Avenue Terrace today, in the year 43, the imposing wall, the houses in the shadow of the tower, the archive of avatars in the basement, and the family inside all remain still, unlikely as it may be, together. On Christmas Eve, 1968, three astronauts inside Apollo 8 became the first human beings to orbit the moon, glimpse its mysterious dark side with their own eyes, and view Earth as a whole planet. Right before snapping the famous photograph that would become known as Earthrise, Backup Command Module Pilot William Anders exclaimed, "Oh my God! Look at that picture over there! There's the Earth coming up! Wow, is that pretty!" NASA informed the crew that its television broadcast on December 24th would garner the largest audience that had ever listened to a human voice. They received no guidance on what their message should contain, so the astronauts chose a passage from the book of Genesis. "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth," William Anders read. And God said, Let there be light, and there was light. On Christmas Day, upon successfully exiting their lunar orbit, Command Module Pilot Jim Lovell told Mission Control, Please be informed there is a Santa Claus. The spacecraft re-entered the Earth's atmosphere on December 27th, safely landing in the Pacific Ocean. The mission had lasted 6 days, 3 hours, and 48 minutes. Call it an astral week.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Astral Weeks, A Secret History of 1968 by Ryan H. Walsh. Read by Stephen Hoy. This program was directed by Richard Brewer. Executive Producer, Dan Musselman. Music by Hallelujah the Hills, with special guests Dana Colley, Tanya Donnelly, Josh Cantor, and Marissa Nadler. Engineered and mixed by Seth Manchester at Machines with Magnets. Text copyright 2018 by Ryan H. Walsh. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.